Welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zaro-Kopinski. We have a very special guest on the podcast this week, Anne Bogle, author of I'd Rather Be Reading, The Delights and Dilemmas of the Reading Life. And fellow book nerds, you probably know Anne from her wonderful blog, Modern Mrs. Darcy, and of course her podcast, What Should I Read Next?, which I know I listen to every week and always come away with great book recommendations. Anne joins me to discuss the inspiration behind this new essay collection, how she approaches raising readers, her modern Mrs. Darcy journey, and much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Anne Bogle, welcome to A Bookish Home. I am sure listeners out there will relate when I say that getting to chat with you is sort of a book nerd dream come true. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, that's so kind. And it's my pleasure.
So you have created one of my favorite corners of the internet. You have the Modern Mrs. Darcy blog, which is such a go-to for readers. And of course, the What Should I Read Next podcast, where you are a literary matchmaker. And you've really brought together a community of readers that I just think it's so lovely to be part of. And congratulations on your book. It's called I'd Rather Be Reading, The Delights and Dilemmas of the Reading Life. And I enjoyed it so much. I think it would be a wonderful gift for book nerds for the holidays. And I'd love to just hear how you decided to sort of explore your reading life in this way and why you wanted to take this on as your next project.
That's a great question. I really started thinking about the questions I discuss and I'd Rather Be Reading, I think back in 2011, when I started talking about books publicly for the first time, which really wasn't something I'd done. Previously, I'd interacted with my fellow students, I'd interacted with friends and even neighbors, because books are a great way to connect with people. But I'd never interacted with so many readers that I didn't have any connection to aside from the internet. And those conversations that I had over the years really got me thinking about what I'd really like to distill in a volume you could hold in your hands. There are issues that I've enjoyed exploring over the last almost 10 years now, and that I know resonate with my fellow readers.
They really do. And you dive into so many facets of your reading life and also growing up. And I guess just to start toward the beginning, you share how a move into a particular house was really sort of the catalyst for some big changes in your reading life. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. When I was so young, I happened to move into a house next door to the library. And it's funny, now I'm older and now I've had almost my 20th college reunion is coming up. Or has it already happened? No, it's still coming up, Laura. So I've had a lot of adult living behind me. I lived in three different places. And every time, it's like I haven't looked. The house has just kind of fallen into our lap. So we bought the first house we looked at, my husband and I, or actually I bought it before he was officially legally mine. But the house happened to be next door to a really wonderful branch of the Louisville Free Public Library. And at the time, I thought that was a fun perk. But in hindsight, and really it's only in the course of this collection, I thought, oh, was that, a fun bonus? Or was that in some small way, like a predictor of my fate? And what I really have in mind here is Winston Churchill famously said, first we shape our buildings and then they shape us. And Malcolm Gladwell writes in Outliers about how we think we're masters of our destiny, but really we're in many ways, products of our environment. And living next door to the library, books were part of my life in a much more ever-present, everyday way than I think they would have been if I lived across town from one, because the books were always right there for me. And we took advantage of that. First as a, single working person, and then as a parent. And then as I got older and I started working on Modern Mrs. Darcy, the books being next door was a huge factor in all those areas of my life.
I love that. And even I know you mentioned there's times where you and your kids are running into the library in bathing suits, and it's just, you're just constantly in and out picking up holds. It's such a lovely description. And I'm sure, as I was reading, I was thinking, wow, I wonder, for your kids growing up next door to that library, it would seem like there couldn't be a better way to start off kind of raising readers than that constant access to library books.
Right. It's just part of your life. And I've always hoped that my kids would take books and reading for granted in the best kind of way. Mm-hmm. Just ever present, reliable, always there.
Well, that was one of the things I noticed. I'm sure people are curious, you know, how you became a reader. And in the book, you talk about how your parents, your mom was sort of a library person and your dad was a bookstore person. Was reading a big part of your family life growing up?
Looking back, I think it was just in the sense I just described. Books were ever present, always there. My mom did take me to the library and my brother regularly, and my dad preferred to go to the bookstore, as I write about, and I'd rather be reading. But they didn't make a big deal of it. Like, I don't think I ever heard my mom or my dad say, you know what I really love to do? I'd love to sit down with a big book. But we were surrounded by books and they were often reading them. And they read them to us when I was little, especially my dad. And I didn't really realize this until I started I'd Rather Be Reading, but my mom read to us. But my childhood memories of my dad, of being read to by my parents, are with my dad with a big stack of books on the couch. And again, they didn't make a big deal of it, like, hey kids, don't you love reading? But books were always around us, and it was something that was built into the rhythm of our lives.
I think it's interesting you talk about not making a big deal of it. That's one thing that sort of stuck out with me. I've listened, you know, I'm a devoted listener of your podcast. And I remember hearing you talk about recommending books to your kids, because I'm always thinking about, I have a toddler and I've been a school librarian. You know, how do we, you know, pass on our bookish love to our kids? And I remember you saying that you'll just sort of like leave books around the house you think your kids might be interested in, but so maybe sort of what you're saying, not make too much of a big deal of it, to maybe turn them off. Has that sort of been your approach to kind of do it a little more subtly?
Yes, for sure. Kids don't like to be sold any more than adults do. And depending on the age and stage in a child, or, you know, older kids, a teen's life, they're reading, what they choose to read says a lot about the identity they are pursuing, who they see themselves, who they want to be. And for you to come in and be like, hey, here's a great book, I think you'll love this, takes half of the fun out of it, because part of the thrill of reading is the thrill of discovery. And I try to leave that door open for my children and the other children in my life. This isn't to say like I never recommend books to my kids. I will, but generally speaking, only when they ask me. But also at this point, I think we've established the trust where I can say, you know, I came across this book today and it's about this topic and you may want to check it out. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't buy it and wrap it up with a bow and put it at their place at the dinner table and be like, hey, you are going to love this. Now, which I'll let their friends do that for them. You know, it's a practice. I think it's hard for a lot of people because it's so different from what they've done. And I think a lot of times, well, we know as adults that the most powerful recommendations are from readers who are very enthusiastic about a book that they loved and they want us to read. But when you're in a power position with a child, it's really easy to like shove the book upon them, mm-hmm. instead of gently hold it out to them so that this wonderful work of literature is beckoning. So it does feel different, but I do think it can become a habit, and to invite someone to read instead of attempt to almost force them to read, mm-hmm. I think really lets them approach the book in a new way.
Yeah, you write in the book about realizing you'd been book bossy, and I'm sure we're all guilty of that at times. It can be hard when you're so enthusiastic about a particular title, or I think you had sent a book to a friend that you thought would be just perfect for them, and then realized maybe that wasn't the best move. But yeah,
it was so bad. Well, and I've been really surprised at how much reader reactions I've heard from that specific chapter. And the story I tell in that book is that a friend went through a horrible breakup. It was so bad. And I sent her a book that was perfect for her interest. And you know how I was just saying, like, you can recommend a book to a child and say, like, hey, saw this, thought it had your name on it, check it out. So I sent her one book like that, but I sent her another one that was just so judgmental and horrible. Like, I thought it would be good for her. And you would never send somebody like a vitamin supplement, you know, or like, it's almost so like true. Buying somebody like a gym membership that they haven't asked for.
Yep.
You need to get yourself in shape. And I know what will do it. And this is what you should do with your life. And when it comes to reading life, should is so dangerous. Mm-hmm. So I've learned not to be book bossy. And then I wrote about that and I'd rather be reading. And I've gotten so many sheepish emails from readers that say, oh, wow, that one really made me think. I mean, not sheepish in that, you know, they're not embarrassed to write me or anything, but they've written me and said like, oh, I'm rethinking some conversations I've had about books with people.
Yep. I think if you are a bookish person, you have probably been there. But I love that that is sort of your approach with the podcast too. And if people aren't familiar, you invite a guest on and they share three books they love, a book they hate, and what they've been reading lately. And then your book recommendations are really tailored to them and their interests, not just like we're saying, here's that book you have to read or you should read. And I really love that. And it got me thinking as I was reading your book, you know, you had talked about how at one point you had dreamed of maybe working in a bookstore, and now we know sort of how that turned out, and you have the blog and you're this literary matchmaker on what should I read next. How did you sort of decide that this was that corner of the book world where you could really thrive and where you'd enjoy being instead of maybe being in a bookstore or being a librarian or all the number of sort of bookish jobs you could have?
I don't think there was any one moment of decision where I said, all right, this is the plan, but it just happened baby step by baby step. And then one day you wake up and you look around and you're like, oh, I think I'm working in books now, because Modern Mrs. Darcy didn't start as a book blog. But what I do love about blogging, what it has in common with a lot of creative pursuits, is that you can experiment and you can learn what you like by trying things out. And it's so easy to pivot and pursue more of what you really love and what you find resonates with people and less of what does not bring you joy when you're sitting at your computer. But I've never done like book reviews. There's tons of book review blogs on the internet. And I think I've written maybe three in all my years on Modern Mrs. Darcy. Although if the New York Times wants me to review something, by all means, send me that email. Exactly. I'll branch out there. But I did find that I enjoyed writing about books, even writing about specific books in like an insight I gleaned or connecting that to real life or connecting unlikely things through the lens of literature. I really enjoyed that. And you couldn't like, that didn't fit nicely in a niche. And when I started Modern Mrs. Darcy in 2011, the number one rule is you need a defined niche or nobody's going to read your blog because that is how it works. But it's never really had one. And that's worked out okay. Because I think while we haven't had like a defined subject, we have had a pretty tight demographic that I know I'm writing towards, which is women. 95% of the readers are women, although more men do listen to the podcast, probably because it's not named after a Jane Austen character, but writing to women who are thoughtful and inquisitive and want to really dig into the issues that matter in life, even if they don't necessarily have like shopping links attached to them.
Right.
And really, it's a pretty nerdy bunch. Like one of my favorite descriptions of Modern Mrs. Darcy, not mine, but a friend's to me, is that it's a lifestyle blog for nerds. And it just so happens over the years. Yeah. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. That I realized that writing about books was something I really enjoyed doing. And that's when we started doing like explicit reading guides and book lists and things like that. Because I really do feel like if you get more out of your reading life, you can't help but get more out of the rest of your life. So I did lean harder into the books, but well, it's still not all books all the time.
Right. Well, I wasn't there for the early days, but I know blog.
That's best, Laura. Some of those early posts. I got a notification from Google this past weekend that said like, you have a link broken, go fix it. And the link was from 2011. So I was looking at the posts I wrote when the blog was like 6 weeks old. I think it's probably best for all of us that you don't have that in your readerly memory.
Well, I was going to say, I have such a distinct memory of finding your blog and your podcast maybe 4 years ago. I was listening to Books on the Nightstand. I don't know if you still listen to that podcast, but when it was going to be stopping, when they decided not to do it anymore, they had an episode where they sort of were helping their listeners find new book podcasts. And I remember I was like on a walk and they started describing what should I read next. And I, you know, just thought it sounded wonderful and immediately went and started listening to it. And from there found your blog, and I am always reading that, and I listen to the podcast every week, and it really has enhanced my reading life a great deal. And I know that's true for so many people. Has that been just really gratifying to know that you've added sort of another dimension to people's reading lives and helped them connect with more books and find each other too, sort of find a community?
Of course, it's nice to feel like you're connecting people in that way and bringing good things into their life. But it also feels like kind of a scary responsibility sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I do love Books on the Nightstand. We had a full circle moment on the blog recently when Anne Kingman came on to help me recommend books for readers' holiday wish lists.
Oh, that's
but
true.
I do remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was so kind of them. And I just really loved that Michael Kindness said I sounded like Delilah.
Yes, people wrote me and
said, are you okay with this? Like if Michael said it, I'm great.
Yeah, I do remember that. Well, you know, I'm curious, when you're starting out in 2011, all the way through now, when did the blog really start to take off? And were there times where you sort of wondered, oh, should I stick with this? And I guess sort of what was that journey like?
That's interesting. It just started as an experiment. I should probably say in all these conversations, whether we're talking about like gently holding books out to children or starting a blog, that I am an experimenter. I'm an INFP type 9. And I am okay with making things up as I go. And I think that served me really well over the years, but I can't look back and say that there was like one moment in time where I went, oh, this is going to work. But there's so many small steps. Like I do remember when people started commenting on Modern Mrs. Darcy early, and I was like, oh, there are people reading this out there. So that was fun. And I remember fairly early when a fellow blogger, Hallie Lord, bless her heart, I love you, Hallie, wrote a blog post that said, have you met the Modern Mrs. Darcy? I found this blog and it was so fun. And that felt like, oh, people are reading this. Mm-hmm. And then I remember when I made my first affiliate commission, somebody bought like vitamin E through my site and I got 40 cents. And I was like, that's a milestone. First time. Here we go. But I don't think the good and bad of a creative pursuit like this is there's never a moment in time where you can be like, yep, I did it. I made it. Mm-hmm. Here we are.
And it just keeps evolving and keeps evolving. Well, I'm sure you've made a lot of bookish connections through your work, and you write in I'd Rather Be Reading about your book twin, which I loved the idea of, someone who has a really similar taste to you, where you can be recommending books to one another and sort of vetting them. How did you find your book twin?
Oh, well, through trial and error, of course. how all things happen in my life, apparently. I'm noticing a theme here. Yes, it's true. Something I've thought about for many years, like predating the blog, is how does a reader know before they pick up a book that it's any good for them? And if you're a reader who's ever been disappointed in something you've read, I think you know what I'm talking about. Like when I graduated from college and all of a sudden had to make my reading life my own, like when I went into the library, I wasn't checking books out that were on a list. I was just trying to find something I would enjoy reading. And for the first time in a while, I was really able to read contemporary fiction on a regular basis. And I was so bad at picking it out. I'd hear a book described as like, oh, this is amazing, probably in People magazine. And I'd read it and I didn't think it was amazing. So what was I doing wrong? And so I've thought a lot over the years about how books are reviewed and how we talk about books and how we can read one of those things like a review or listen to a friend. And how do we listen for the cues that tell us, yes, that book is for you, or it's good that they liked it, but you, reader, need to keep moving. So
yeah, I think that's really valuable. I know I was an English major and went through this as well, where, you know, I loved all the books that my, you know, professors were assigning me, and I thought that was great. And then you finish and wonder, oh, okay. So I went from having this constant required reading list, which granted I loved, to I'm just gonna, you know, wander aimlessly in the bookstore, in the library, wondering what to read. So I think that idea of sort of figuring out your taste and listening for those cues of whether the book is right for you or not is really helpful.
Yes. And one of the things I found most helpful in steering my way to books I'm likely to enjoy and avoiding the ones that, regardless of how good they may or may not be, are not for me, is to pay attention to readers whose taste is similar to your own. And nobody is going to be a carbon copy of your reading life. No one's going to love exactly the same stuff and hate exactly the same stuff and find the same stuff mediocre. But we do often cluster as readers. And so I know, whether I'm browsing Instagram or talking to a friend, there are people who reliably enjoy books that I also enjoy. And so over time, you realize that, oh, there's this one person who matches up very neatly with my own reading habits. And I talk about in I'd Rather Be Reading how my book twin does read a little darker than me, and I'm a little more patient with slowly developing lyrical kind of novels where nothing happens. But I know those things about our respective reading lives, and I can factor them in when I'm considering if I want to read something that she just read. And knowing that if this person has read a book and can be like, eh, it was fine, I got so much stuff to read, Laura. Like, I know that I can just skip that and move on to better stuff. And whether or not you have a book twin, like single individual, I think it helps so many readers to pay attention to, okay, where do I get my best book recommendations? Which sources can really be trusted? And how can I put that to work in my own reading life? And of course, to that, it's also really helpful to be able to articulate what often works for you and why.
Well, I think
a lot of people don't. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think your podcast is a really good place to start with that too, because you're sort of giving a reading profile for the person as they come on. So you can sort of listen and think, oh, well, they're telling me that was one of their favorites, but I absolutely hated that book. So I might be interested in the books that are recommended, and they're fun to maybe check out, but this might not be the person whose taste is going to mirror mine. So Anne's recommendations might not mirror that. But then when you have a guest on who I'm seeing, like, oh, I really loved that one and that one. And oh, they're saying they hated that book. I hated that too. It can be really helpful to kind of find those mirrors and then pay extra close attention to those recommendations and add them to your TBR list. So I feel like even that can be a nice way to sort of start to figure out what some of your book twins might be.
Yes, exactly. And just listening to not only the books they did or didn't enjoy, but the reasons why. Hear somebody say, like, oh, there's nothing I love more than, oh, I don't know, a novel that ends in mystery and you have to figure out what happened next. I mean, I'm sure that there are people sitting in their cars, like banging the speaker going, what is wrong with you? That's a wonderful thing. But you may not have realized that thing about your own reading life until you hear somebody else articulate it. And then you can go, oh, that's me. Or, well, I've never heard it put like that, but no, thank you.
One of the things I was also curious about is, you know, there's so many wonderful essays in here. And of course you were still doing your podcast and writing the blog while you were writing it. And I'm just curious what your routine was like when you were working on this collection?
That's a great question. I do tend to cycle through projects throughout the year because I do have the blog and the podcast, and we run the Modern Mrs. Darcy Book Club, and those things all take time. But during book writing season, writing a book takes a lot of time, and it does require a different routine. So it did look like less blogging during my core book writing season for I'd Rather Be Reading. I recorded a bunch of podcast episodes in advance so I could just focus on the book. But I love writing in the early mornings. Those really work for me. Late at night would be great too. Just, I love writing when I have the house to myself and everybody's asleep. But I can't do both, sadly. So for me, it's the early morning. And I would often write for like an hour or two before everybody got up and then come back to it in the core of the day. Really for my writing routine for the book, as well as other things, I've learned that managing my energy and my mental stamina are really, really important. So almost nothing in this book was written after 1 p.m. because at 2, I feel like I'm a mental zombie and the 1 o'clock hour is iffy. And I write, I make so many drafts for each essay I wrote here. And I think I actually wrote twice as many essays as made it into the book. And then we went through the fun / painful process of deciding what was going to make the cut and then what order were they going to go in. But I love to write and see how it looks and then walk away from it for a while and come back, do it again. And I feel like every time I sit down, it gets a little better and a little better. So it looks like so many drafts over time. Also, I really love paper. I write on a laptop and Scrivener, but for actually seeing how the words sound on the page, there's nothing like real paper. My kids are like, "Mom, that's so wasteful." Is the brain power I would needlessly expend if I tried to do this on a screen. I don't know. There's just something about reading on the actual page that makes me see the words, and especially structure. I have a really hard time with structure, but seeing it on the page really helps me see it differently.
I understand that. Do you do most of your writing at home, or do you need to get out of the house to do it?
This book, I did most of it at home. That has not been true historically, but that works for me now. Now, I have definitely written it at home at the stage where I feel like it's time to print it out and spread it out across the largest work surface in the house, which is usually the island in the kitchen at the past two houses. It was the dining room table in my first house by the library. And to see what it looks like all in one place. I don't know. I never thought I was a visual person because I'm not like a painter, but I finally realized that words are a visual medium and I need to be able to see them all and how they relate to each other, or I just can't get to a structure that makes sense.
No, I think that makes total sense. I worked in publishing for a little while after college, and I remember like I could really only, I was doing like proofreading and things like that, and I really could only do it if it was a physical page and I could circle things and mark it up. I just feel like you can't, I don't know, there is something about having it physically in your hands and having it all be right there in front of you, I think is really helpful. Well, I know you probably have a list a mile long, but I would be curious what some of the books on your nightstand lately have been, just a few that you've read that you've been really excited about that you'd want to recommend to listeners.
Oh, well, okay. So two parts to this question are, what are the books on my nightstand? And what would I recommend to listeners? I don't know that those are the same thing. I'm an urban planning nerd. So there have been some great books that have come out this fall. I'm almost done with The High Cost of Free Parking, which is this 800-page textbook about parking that I've been working my way through for forever. I really like to see how things are made and how the structure impacts the experience. I finally realized like this is why I like to reread. This is why I'm fascinated with like the behind the scenes of any television show. And this, I'd like to see how our cities are made. So there've been some good books that have come out in the past couple of years that are so good about this topic. I really love the new Walkable City Rules. I think it's called Walkable City Rules. It's 101 patterns in cities that, so he's writing about things like parallel parking, and it's fascinating. And then I just got a new book called Fixing Your City that's on my nightstand, but haven't read it yet. Don't know if it's any good. Will.
Well, I have to take the opportunity, since I have you on, to ask for a recommendation for myself. So to give you a sense, I will say, I am taking a few weeks. I know you mentioned rereading. I am also a big rereader. And I'm taking a few weeks to relax and reread three of my favorites, Little Women, Anne of Green Gables, and Pride and Prejudice, which, I know some of those are up your alley as well. And I'd be curious if there is a contemporary book that you would recommend for someone like me who goes back to those sorts of reads quite a bit?
Yes, that's a fun question. The thing about all of those books is, oh, there is no real like 21st century equivalent. You can see what you like about them and then look for those same qualities. But any like Pride and Prejudice retelling is vastly different than Pride and Prejudice. Mm-hmm. And I think when readers when writers try to get too close to the original, it's just not fun. That being said, there are some really fun Pride and Prejudice retellings that have come out in 2018 and are coming in 2019. Heartstone is Pride and Prejudice with dragons, which I never would have read had an enthusiastic bookseller not said, "No, really, this is good. You have to read it."
That's very different.
It is very different. There's a novel called Pride by the author of American Street that came out this fall.
Is it set in Brooklyn or?
Teenagers in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Yeah.
Darcy rolls up in his blacked out SUV.
Someone I had on a few weeks ago recommended that. So that's been on my list. I've got to check that out. I think that would be up my alley. It's a good time of year for some Pride and Prejudice retellings as well, I feel like. Something about this season.
And then shortly in early 2019, there's a new Pride and Prejudice set in Pakistan called Unmarriageable, which is wry in irreverence and fun. Like the Bingley sisters are heiresses to, I think, a maxi pad empire. So this is the tone for Unmarriageable. But oh, let me think. For Little Women, Anne of Green Gables, and Pride and Prejudice, which it's funny, we lump those books together, but they're so different. Like Jane Austen is so funny and snarky, but not quite mean. And I think in contemporary Jane Austen wannabe spheres, it just sounds mean.
Well, part of it might be too that I think for a lot of us, they've become sources of comfort because we keep going back to them, but they are maybe very different themselves. But I feel like they're the kinds of books that every time you read them, you notice something different. And I don't know, they're just something about this time of year too. I just want to go to the familiar, and not that bad things don't happen in those books, but you sort of leave feeling, you know, like your heart is warmed a bit.
You're so right that those books really do hold up over time. Okay. I have two titles for you. So if you want a book that channels some of Anne Shirley's wide-eyed wonder about the world, I would really recommend Harry's Trees by John Cohen. I'm so glad. It came out in 2018. It's by the author of The Man in the Window. And also, I found out when we talked for the podcast, he wrote the screenplay for Minority Report. So this is a man. Okay, forget Minority Report, because that is not going to give you any idea of what Harry's Trees is like. That's just a fun little factoid. But
I will definitely look that one up.
Yep. Set in rural Pennsylvania. It's a story of unlikely friendship, hope in the face of hard things, books within books, and the power of people who love them.
I do love books within books.
I'm evaluating how that sounded off the cuff. Yeah, there's a book within a book and a precocious child who is precocious but manages not to be twee, because like a child who's trying too hard to be endearing in the book or on the page, I get really annoyed with that. I don't think she goes there. But it's a little bit whimsical and fairy tale-ish, but more of an ordinary magic. Like the magic is more a way of looking at life. So it does feel like a little bit sparkly, but there's nothing in that book that couldn't actually happen. And then for Anne of Green Gables fans, especially, there's a new historical fiction by Sarah McCoy. It came out this fall. It's called
Marilla of Green Gables. Yes. I just had her on a couple weeks ago. Yeah. I love that one.
Budge Wilson's Becoming Green Gables, which has been out for years and it's on my bookshelf and I still haven't read, but Marilla.
I haven't done that one yet either.
I need a really beautiful cover. Mm-hmm. It's that, well, so you and your readers know it's her imagining of what Marilla's life was like as a child and up until the time when Anne entered her and Matthew's life. And it does go in some directions I don't expect, but I feel like she's really, I felt like I was in good hands because, oh, you know, when people mess with your favorites, you can get a little tense and so I think Alexander McCall Smith said, one messes with the classics at one's peril, because he wrote it for the Jane Austen Project. He reinterpreted Emma, and people get really mad with what you do to their beloved characters. But I felt like she was very respectful, and I really loved the writing style. And while it did go in one specific direction I wasn't expecting, I was intrigued and not like, what have you done?
I totally agree. And in talking to her, it was so clear she came at it with such a love and knowledge of the books. And she even told some anecdotes about how, like, she was a fan as a kid to the point where her and her mom made her own dress with puff sleeves. She had Anne of Green Gables parties, and she talked about all the research she did for the book. So you can really tell she was coming at it as a kindred spirit. And she was also saying, I don't know if you noticed when you were reading, there's sort of a gap of a few years in the book. And I was asking her if there are any more books to come. And she said, there might be some more books in the works that will sort of explore the years she kind of has to gloss over a little bit in Marilla's story. So that would be something to look out for as well. I hope there's more of those.
Yeah. And then some recommendations. So for Pride and Prejudice fans, A.S. Byatt is a British author who writes women so, so well. She has that dry British humor. It's not the same tone, but there's a huge overlap between people who love the one author and love the other. And also Anne Tyler, also the way she portrays human nature. Mm-hmm. And for Little Women fans, Rosamund Pilcher is another British author who just writes about families and close circles so well. She portrays relationships in a really easy and fun to read way on the page, but also in a really like profound and thought-provoking way. Goes down easy, but has great depth.
Well, those sound great. Thank you so much. And I am so happy you were able to come on today. It was such a great, it was such a delight to get to talk books with you. And I definitely hope that listeners go pick up a copy of I'd Rather Be Reading, either for themselves or to give as a gift to a fellow book nerd. I think it would be a great holiday present. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I hope you're able to stop by your local library or bookstore to pick up a copy of I'd Rather Be Reading. This essay collection would also make the perfect holiday gift for the readers in your life. You can find out more about Anne on her blog, modernmrsdarcy.com. She's also on social media at Anne Bogle. For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can head over to my blog, abookishhome.com. There you'll also find book recommendations and ideas for creating a culture of reading in your home. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with a friend or on social media. It would also be so helpful if you could rate and review in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts to help people find the show. And of course, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening and happy reading.